You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
Our guest today is William Webster, Judge William Webster. He was originally trained as a lawyer and served in the 70s as a federal district court judge and then as a federal court of appeals judge. And in 1978, President Carter appointed him the third director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. From there, in 1987, President Reagan appointed him to head the CIA, succeeding William Casey. And he served in that position until August 31st, 1991. And I'm very pleased to say that he is a founding member of the board of the International Spy Museum and has been a source of both knowledge and motivation for all of us. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director, and we'll go right into our conversation. We're delighted to have you here. And
Thank you, Peter. Let me
just ask you, when you were appointed to go to the FBI, you had not come up through the ranks. This is always an issue. I remember it was. I'm CIA, as you know, by background. And what were your first impressions of that culture, that corporate culture of going in there, and particularly after the very long tenure of J. Edgar Hoover and the great interest in people and what you would do at the FBI?
Well, first, I have to qualify what you said just a bit, because I served under President Eisenhower as United States Attorney, where I worked very closely in prosecution of cases in violation of federal law with FBI officials, many of whom were my friends. I still have some very dear friends from going back a long, long way to the Korean War, as a matter of fact, where I now room with platoon leader from Iwo Jima, Marine, who was an FBI special agent chasing spies in Pearl Harbor when I picked up my ship when I was called back into service in the Navy in the Korean War.
So you were among friends, as it were.
I felt I was comfortable with them. I was comfortable with their sense of honesty, their forthrightness, and their loyalty to the organization and to the country. So that was never a problem. The problem, really, the challenge was that the FBI had, along with CIA, been scrutinized in the Church and Pike Committee reports, congressional reports in those early years, where there was confusion and contention, and the Church Committee said that the FBI should stay at home, the CIA should stay abroad, and they shouldn't really spend much time with each other. So during that period of time, the FBI had engaged in counterintelligence work and had participated in things that became known pejoratively as black bag jobs, other things that had not been well and clearly within our constitutional authority. So the FBI, in a way, was, I won't stay down and out, but they were feeling the impact of that level of criticism. And while I was very happy on the court, I was persuaded by the then Attorney General, Griffin Bell, he had himself been a appellate judge, that they needed someone like me, and I wasn't sure that was correct. But I, not in order to start any rumors, I took myself to the public library by myself and read everything I could about what was going on, and I convinced myself that this was too important an organization not to get back on full track, and that if we were looking for, if I were looking for somebody that might have an easier course in doing that, it would be someone with my kind of background. So with that kind of analysis, and with a little pushing from other friends who thought it would be right, a great opportunity to do some serious public service, I agreed to do it.
Of course, since you were there, really, the counterintelligence has grown larger and larger as a mission of the FBI. And of course, now with the challenge of terrorism, and particularly domestic terrorism, we've seen that even loom larger at the Bureau. What do you recall when you did go? What were the major counterintelligence issues?
Well, first, if I could, let me say that the FBI had expanded from purely criminal, traditional criminal activity to a series of priorities, one of which was foreign counterintelligence. I think that work had been going on under J. Edgar Hoover and Clarence Kelly, but it was a top priority. The others were as listed as top priorities were organized crime and white-collar crime. So those were the principle, that not the only thing, of course, they did, but those were given special emphasis. And then in 1980, I added terrorism to the category of top priorities. Now, I bet I didn't answer your question.
No, you got it, because the priorities in the Bureau have changed virtually during your time and since.
Right.
Let me touch on one of the things that is such a preoccupation of the media, and that is often the focus on in looking at the intelligence community, particularly relations between the CIA and the FBI during that period, and when the cases came up afterwards. That was a favorite topic of the "let's you and him fight," you know. So, was that? Do you recall? Have a sense of how the relations were when you went over, when you went to the Bureau?
Yes, I do. I have to generalize a little bit about this, but first the staffing, the recruitment. The source of federal agents of the FBI, special agents of the FBI, and officers of the CIA, somewhat different. Many of the officers from CIA, including not only the analysts, but the operations officers and so forth, came on the recommendations of professors from Yale University. Now, that's not the only place, but they were a major source of supply. They had a certain attitude about how good they were, and they were good. The FBI recruited from a different range of people, and they had a different approach, which made for differences. The FBI preached that every special agent would do, he had to know when he came aboard, he was expected to be able to do everything within the jurisdiction of the FBI, every kind of activity. And he was prepared to go anywhere he was assigned, wherever that might be. Over at the CIA, things were somewhat different, partly because they had some highly skilled specialists. Over 3,500 PhDs were there, who didn't really want to assume that universal blanket responsibility. They wanted to work their specialty. In fact, when I went over there, I found that if you say, who do you work for? Rarely would you hear, I work for the CIA, even if that was not a secret. But or would they say, with the intelligence director, it would be, I work for SOVA, which was short for Soviet Analysis. Yes. And they like to stay with their specialties, and they like not to be fungible. So there were differences in approaches that reflected initial differences that we have largely, I want to emphasize, overcome. I used to shorten it this way, that the folks at the FBI referred to their counterparts in CIA as children of privilege. And the folks at the CIA referred to the FBI as the long gray line at Fordham.
Okay. Well.
And so those were the kinds of differences. Today, if I might carry that thought a little further, they recruit from the same 100 colleges and universities. They're more alike in so many ways. And after the Patriot Act was passed, after 9/11, sure, and that concern about failure of imagination and so on, they've had more occasion to work together because need to know changed to need to share, and their activities were more collaborative. And they found, not to their surprise, but because of their experience, they were all both very good at what they did, and they could and did work together differently.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly the sense I hear from both the leadership of the Bureau and of CIA. In other words, the collaborative aspect has done nothing but improve over the years, particularly since 9/11, when the whole community pretty much had to draw the wagons in a circle and contend with a common enemy. You certainly recall one of the major cases on your watch was John Walker, the naval petty officer who actually had recruited his son and tried to recruit his daughter and had, I think, one cousin and a brother involved. Right. Did you become quite involved in that, in the course of it?
Yes, I was, but of course, I relied upon those most skilled in counterintelligence activities to develop the case, identify the problem, find out who was responsible for the problem, and take the case forward. I think that in either agency, when someone went bad, as they rarely did, but when they did, it was almost like you'd been betrayed. And so that made it very important that we get to the bottom of it and deal with it. Later on, as you may wish to talk about the Hansen case, probably the worst damage done was by Robert Hansen, and that was quite a story. And I was heavily involved in that one.
Can you just talk about that a bit, about the Hansen case?
Was an unusual fellow. He did not quite fit the collegial attitude inside the FBI that was there. And he never really seemed to appreciate that he was valued for what he could do. He had some unique talents, one of them being with technology. And he knew very well how to use technology for his purposes, better than most, for which he did not receive any particular credit by way of advancement and the other kinds of things. And he tended to chafe on that he was left out of some of these things. So, and it affected his loyalty and anger and other concerns of that kind. The interesting thing is that defected in the sense that when he got recruited recruited himself to the Soviet Union, he was unknown to them, and he was very, very careful and clever about how he did this. But because he was active in technology, he had access to any kind of information about individuals and what were in the files and so forth. But he was very careful how he handed up that information, where he handed it up, where the drops were made, and things of that kind. And what I felt badly that it took too long to find him. I was gone from the Bureau by that time and out of the CIA.
Yes, I was called back by the director
to run a study of the Hansen case. Just as it was happening, Louis Free was the director at that time. And while I was embarrassed that they had not, the FBI had not found him, neither had the Soviets. They didn't, the Russians did not know who this man was who was providing so much useful information to them. And they were afraid to spook him by trying to find out. So whatever he wanted, he got.
Yeah.
And he would come in and out for over 20 years. He would work for a while, and then for various reasons, he would back away. But even right up to the very end, they didn't know who was this mysterious person giving them more information. We lost more people through executions and otherwise than any other person.
Well, it was during the early 80s that we were losing assets, that is, agents,
yes,
in the CIA sense, sources, in the Soviet Union particularly. And was that something you were aware of before you left, that there were these, that we were experiencing losses and no one really knew why? But this is before Hansen and Ames, of course, had been uncovered.
Well, it was off and on. Yes, we knew they were picked up. Somebody, one in particular, his name I cannot recall now, were very happy when he was been recalled to the, so he was being sent over there, and they were very happy in the office because now we'll get more information. Well, he was being recalled to be apprehended and executed, so it was, we didn't know why. We knew that somehow, I'll make a generalization that may be surprising, not to take you off your discussion here, but more times than not, we located traitors, spies, defectors by other informants that we had recruited.
Yes.
As the saying was, it takes a spy to catch a spy.
Sure.
And that was true in both agencies. And so we did get information, not always in knowledge, because they didn't know who it was, but they knew enough about little details and facts that permitted the organization to put the case together to pinpoint who it was they were looking for.
One of the major secrets that Hansen had divulged to the Soviets was what had been an FBI initiative to create some sort of tunnel. Mm-hmm. This was mentioned, as I remember, in the charging affidavit, and I don't think a great deal has come out since then. I think Judge Free comments on it in his book. Was that something you were aware of would want to comment on?
If you're talking about tunnels, I immediately think of tunnels into the Soviet embassy here being one of the
things we did.
We all made some bad mistakes. I don't know whether to take responsibility for any of them or not, but I guess I take my share. But one of them was not who built the building. For some reason, we were willing, we being a U.S. government, was willing to allow the Soviets to build their own embassy, whereas we allowed them to build our embassy in Moscow. And of course, I have actually given somewhere out here in display at the museum is a piece
we have it
of the material.
It's in the museum, yes.
That the chief of station gave me that was part of their spy material they put into the pipes and the tubes and everything else. So they didn't know what we were going to use in what rooms, but they knew they could listen into anything if it should turn out to be useful. So this was going on. We allowed that to happen. And on the other hand, we didn't require them to let us build their building. So the tunneling was an afterthought, was a way to see if we could get in. And they were up on a high hill here in Washington, and it was building their new building. And so we were able to move in that direction.
Well, that was one of the major technical sort of secrets that he divulged. You mentioned tunnels and the effect and the embassy. Were you aware when it was finally revealed, when that was in the charging affidavit, had you been aware of that as an activity that the Bureau was engaged in?
Well, I knew about the tunneling, from day one. We had to coordinate that with the State Department and with other government resources and so on.
Well, out of the blue, in 1987, President Reagan invited you to head up the CIA. Do you remember the circumstances of when you sort of got the call, as it were?
I'll say. Well, I'd served for 9 years. I think I was getting ready to go into my 10th and final year as the director of the FBI.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about going back into practice and what I would do next and so forth. Bill Casey had been director of CIA. He had taken with an illness that became terminal. He was in hospital for several weeks and then finally passed away, and resigned and then passed away. So it was pretty obvious at that point there had to be a replacement. And my name, I knew would be apt to come up, although I had no reason to feel certain it would have. And I was focused on leaving, and I was telling the then Attorney General, I think it was a field, would I be interested, was sort of the kind of a question. And then I'd say, I have other plans, I'm ready to go back. I said, I've forgotten how I put it now, but I said, I don't want any emissaries. If it's important enough, if the president wants me, he knows where I am, something like that, a little more politely put. And so I was preparing to do the annual request for budget authorization for the FBI, the whole annual budget, and was getting ready to testify.
So you were on the way to the Hill.
I was really on my way to the Hill within an hour to talk on that, and I was focused on doing a good job and making sure I had everything ready to go. And I got a call from President Reagan, who'd always been very nice to me. We'd gotten along beautifully, and that was not a question of a stranger calling, but he dropped it on me without much fanfare and said he would like me to take over over the CIA, and would I do so? And I told him, very complimented, that he wanted me to do that. And I said, I have to think about, I really want to pray about this. I said, my wife was passed away. I had these children. They're looking forward to getting me back. And I said, I've got to testify in an hour. I said, he wanted to have a press conference that afternoon in the, at the White House, and I was saying, I really would like to have a little more time.
And where were you at the time? Were you in?
I was at FBI headquarters, ready to go up to the Hill. And he was very good about it. Yeah. He said, fine. I didn't realize he'd have to change the date the next day, but that's what he was moved to do. And then when I gave my testimony, I don't remember the order, I got in touch with my children. And I remember my daughter, who later became a huge fan of the CIA, but she said, oh, Dad, I just love the FBI, but that other place is scary.
Well, but by the way, when I first heard that account, my impression was you were actually in your car on the way to the Hill.
Well,
when you got the call.
No, I was at the office. I was actually,
okay.
But I was ready to go.
Right.
The car was ready.
You're going down to the car.
And then I thought it through, and I realized they were supportive. And then I got a call later in the afternoon from Howard Baker, who was his chief of staff, Senator Baker.
Yeah.
And just calling, and no pressure, just wanting so they could make their plans for the next morning. And at that point, I said, I'd be honored to do it. And that was the end.
That's a great story.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
Let's move for a moment to the scary place.
Yeah, it
was extraordinary. You are still the only individual who served as head of both agencies.
Well, I always say, I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. if they don't repeat it, they'll say something about me.
Well, you obviously were there. You wouldn't have been there in either place as long as you were if you hadn't been successful. But I'd be interested to know, you were a prosecuting attorney, a judge. You then headed the senior law enforcement agency of this country. And then you went to the CIA, which is part of the executive branch. But its approach to its work is very different. Its activities overseas, the things it becomes involved in, often skirt the edge of legality, even morality, as we know in our own time. And you've touched a bit on the difference between the two cultures, but what was it like going there? Was there a degree of wariness about you since you were coming from the Bureau? And how did you find that culture when you finally arrived?
Well, those are several questions. I'll try to answer them all wrong.
Thank you. I didn't mean to.
No, that's all right.
That's a load of the
gun.
But
I knew there were some over there that would be concerned that I would be too rigidly by the book, by the league. And I had made a point where the FBI was concerned when I came because of the problems they'd had, emphasizing that. In my remarks in front of the president, the vice president, and the intelligence committees, and everyone who was there, and the chief justice for me, and I said, we're going to do the work that the American people expect of us, and we're going to do it in the way that the Constitution demands of us. And you know, years later, long after I left, that they never forgot that, and they named a conference center for me over there and put that statement on the wall. So it was part of what they understood was their role. Now we switch over to the CIA. The circumstances, the position that I took was not all that different, because what we were doing in terms of gathering intelligence involved espionage, and necessarily we had to cross the laws of other countries from whom we were collecting about whom we were collecting information. The point at which there was some tension with some of the people at the agency, but not many of them, and certainly not in their legal department, was my view that we have to break other people's laws to do the job that the American people expect of us. But we are subject to our own laws, and it is no license to what we are not above the law, and it is no license for us to take liberties with what has been imposed upon us as our duty and our responsibility to follow the Constitution at home. It was that simple, and I never had any real trouble with that, and I don't remember many cases, if any, except in where discipline was necessarily involved, where people had tried to do some of the same things over here that they could get, they could and should do abroad, and we had to call them on that.
Did you find that having been head of the FBI and now going to the CIA, did you find that that really greatly enhanced the cooperation between the very fact that you had been there and now you were at the agency? Did that contribute deal to the collaboration?
Peter, I think it was more a continuation.
Okay.
You know, in fact, I put out some feelers when I knew they were thinking about me at CIA, and the word that came back to me is that we know Webster, and we're comfortable with Webster. So it wasn't who is this guy they're going to inflict on us. So I didn't really expect, although I assumed there would be some who had been pretty successful as pejoratively as cowboys abroad and needed to be reined in somewhat in how they felt they should carry out their duties in the United States.
Well, it was certainly one of my great privileges and honors at the agency to work directly for you as in the media relations field.
It was always a pleasure, Peter.
But that was certainly a highlight. I remember certain things you were stressed very importantly, and among them was trying to develop succession plans for the agency so we wouldn't have to keep bringing people out of retirement or other places to head up the agency. Let me just touch on a final thing as we wind up. And this has been a terrific interview, very direct answers to some tricky questions. We're both now here about a week or so after the NSA leaker Edward Snowden turned up in Hong Kong and made his statement, which has been picked up now. And I think as late as this morning, he has released other information clearly damaging to U.S. national security now. And what we are told is that The Guardian and perhaps others have even more secrets. And this is now June of 2013. What are your thoughts on the case? And it was funny, you and I were discussing it just before this conversation. And I'm thinking back to the president's reaction, President Obama, that he deplored what Snowden did, but welcomed the debate. And I'd be very interested in your reflections right now.
Well, of course, we're in on the beginning of a debate that'll go on for a long, long time. But a couple of things are clear in my mind is that we're ambivalent about intelligence. You remember Deputy Director Vernon Walters, who was later to our UN and Germany and so forth. He said the American people were ambivalent about intelligence. When they were frightened, they wanted a lot of it. And when they didn't, they felt it was somehow a little immoral. And I used to say the same thing about security, that people don't like a lot of security. They want too much security. It's always too much until this day it's not enough. Now, that's the tension that's there. And oftentimes, particularly I noticed it during the last presidential election, there was a tendency when we did something well, such as the takedown of Osama bin Laden, people wanted to talk about the details. Even more dangerously damaging when we were doing significant cyber activities against Iran, because to move them away from their nuclear endeavors, to talk about what we were doing and our worms and so forth, means that we are giving to our enemies the opportunity to correct the situation, to avoid it, to prevent its effectiveness. And that's a lot of damage to do that. And so you can't say, even with the best of motives, you think they're engaging in things they don't really understand. And this one, so far as I can see, was very carefully thought out from the standpoint of what was appropriate and proper. Very clear listening to Director Clapper, the head director of National Intelligence, that we did not listen to where they were looking for information. To this metadata process was a way of getting out in front to recognize trends and do something that we haven't been able to do successfully in the past and are learning how to do, and that is get the information to prevent something from happening, to see it in its incipient stage and find out about it through court-ordered procedures. Every step of the way was designed to protect privacy. They're not listening in on conversations until those conversations become subject to intrusion under a court order because you're doing something they shouldn't. They're foreign agents operating here about doing something. And from the standpoint of how it was structured, I find it difficult to understand why anyone would think they were doing something contrary to law or unconstitutional. They were very careful about that. And getting messages of very information and approaches that would be very useful in improving our resilience, but more importantly, preventing the terrorist activity from taking place. And that's hard to do if you can't get ahead of the game. And so they'll be arguing about whether he was a hero or a traitor, and what to do about him, and that argument will continue, I suppose, whether he's found or not. But I don't have a ready answer for it until people can come to understand the importance of secrecy in gathering sensitive intelligence in order to better protect and safeguard our country.
Yeah. Well, there's no question that he certainly violated his agreements, whether it was with CIA, NSA, or Booz Allen, his oath to protect the secrets. So regardless of how, I mean, in fact, it has held, it triggered the debate, but regardless of that, I'm not hearing a great deal of approval. I'm hearing from some supporters, but I think they fail to understand what he's done to bring this to the public. There are other ways that it could have been
absolutely
done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You took over the agency at a particularly difficult time because it was the Iran-Contra period. And how did that affect your work and the agency at the time, from your perspective?
Well, it in a way, it reminded me of the tough times we had when at the FBI, they were going through this same process. I had no doubt that we would work our way through it. And actions had to be reviewed, and I had them reviewed. I told the Senate I would not open new investigations, but I would review the record, and if action needed to be taken, it would be taken. And we did take action in some places. And we're relieved to find that in most cases, those involved had performed as they should have performed. Iran-Contra, in a way, was not, as I remember it, a CIA activity. These are political people making judgments about arms for hostages and other decisions of that kind. They were relying on various information supplied by the agency, not always relying on the information they got, but that was not the role of the CIA to make that happen. Let me say this, if I could not change the subject, but use a better example than Iran-Contra, and that's how we dealt with covert action. Now, public does not really understand that because it's covert and much of it is secret, but the process is no secret. Covert action occurs when the military means cannot accomplish or support our overt foreign policy as successfully as we would like. covert action occurs when the diplomats are not able by diplomatic means to achieve our objectives. And so the problem is handed back to the intelligence community, particularly the CIA, to come up with an activity that would be covert, that or a series of activities that would support our policy in a particular country or foreign place, make it work. And it would be, of course, be secret. Sometimes it would be propaganda. Sometimes it would be one thing or another. What we did was come up with a plan. And then we vetted it within the CIA, as you probably remember. The obvious things, can we do, is there anything that offends U.S. laws about this? Can we do this legally? Do we have or can we get the funding for it? Are we likely to succeed in our objectives and have a good chance of success if it's done covertly, secretly? And then I threw in a couple more. The word always popular, but I put in, one was easy. Is it consistent with our foreign policy? Because obviously it wouldn't make sense for us to have an overt foreign policy and then a policy that was inconsistent with that we were doing secretly. And so that's a yes or no. The tougher question was, I said, you know, these things ultimately become public down the road. And when they do, will it make sense to the American people? Well, there was a lot of pushback on that. Oh, that's subjective. That's subjective. I said, I know it's subjective, but I want your opinion about it. You're recommending this to me before I submit it to the president. I want you to know, think about it. You know, how will they feel about what we did in a way that relates to the problem? How will they feel about Iran-Contra, you know, when they thought of what we did? Then from there, that process, we met with the full national security. The National Security Council members sat there and asked questions and took shots at what we did in the presence of the president. And the president, following this and our presentation, would make a decision. If he said, let's do it, he made a formal written finding. And that finding was submitted, I believe, within 48 hours to the two intelligence committees of the House and Senate at the top level. So that while it was not, it was still a secret activity, the people who had an interest in what we were doing all got to know, and they got to vet it and debate it, and we came out of it with a process that made sense. I think that's... having a process is very, very sound. I think we're going into periods right now with the use of drones and other things where a process needs to be formed, not just left to the discretion of the president to put people on a targeted kill list or something of that kind, but a process by which we collectively arrived at a decision that can be kept secret, but is sanctioned and would be approved by the American people.
Yeah. Well, the second of your two questions couldn't be more apt, since we now know many of the covert actions that have been carried out in the past, and it raises your question. Do the American people approve of all of those, or are there some they don't? Yeah. And we may learn more in the days to come. Let me ask you one final question on that subject. One of the really dramatic things that happened during your tenure was the coup in Russia, in Moscow, in August of 1991. Do you remember when you first heard about that and what your reactions were at the time?
Well, I don't think I would be stretching things to say that our analysts have been measuring those changes, saw them coming. There were huge personalities, as you know, over there, and Gromyko and Yeltsin and others, different types of things were happening. And other incidents that were affecting Russia, we at CIA had done a great deal to help the Mujahideen, the tribal leaders in Afghanistan, develop the capability to drive the Russians out of their country. Good things were happening there that were not good things at home. There were a lot of people angry with the military, disappointed, and so forth. So things were unsettled. the attempted coup on Gromyko was not unexpected, but came in the way.
On Gorbachev.
I'm sorry.
No, I was processing what you were saying. I was listening
to the Gromyko and thinking, that doesn't sound right. Gorbachev. I had a pleasure of out of Mason University, Gorbachev. Comparing notes as we look back together. Anyway, back to the subject here. What was taking place at that point was dramatic. I was in President Bush's office, in the Oval Office, when he was talking to Yeltsin. And Yeltsin had stood down the tanks that were out in front. And the president, frankly, was, on a personality basis, did not really like Yeltsin as much as he liked
Gorbachev.
And but he changed. He changed his view. He put the phone down. He just said, Mr. President, we're going to arrest those people and fry them and put them in jail. Yeah. And that was one of the standoff moments that I felt were probably pivotal in what was going to happen. And of course, the lights turned out at the end of the year, and there was no war, no violence beyond that.
Yeah, and no more Soviet Union.
And no more Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, Judge Webster, it's been a terrific talking to you this afternoon. A great interview.
And thank you
so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be here, and I congratulate you on a terrific job you have done directing this wonderful spy museum. The public has learned a lot, and they've learned it in the right way.